The following is a meeting with disciples with His Holiness Srila Satsarup Das Goswami on November 1st, 1992 in Vrindavan.
So I wrote down some of the things I wanted to cover. One is, I want to bring out that we should not approach the spiritual master to solve material problems or to satisfy our plans for sense gratification. I want to bring out how the burden is on the disciple to take the right instructions from the spiritual master, but also that the spiritual master is responsible on his side to give the best instructions to liberate the disciple and situate him in pure devotional service. On a practical or personal level, I would like to give some guidelines on how to get spiritual instruction even when you're not on a very high level, even when you are absorbed in material problems. In so many ways, the ideal relationship, disciple and spiritual masters in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna is the original spiritual master. If we want to be disciple, or if our service is to guide disciples, we have the ideal there. So, in the second chapter, verse 7, Arjuna says to Krishna, "And I am confused about my duty and have lost all composure because of miserly weakness. In this condition, I am asking you to tell me for certain what is best for me. And I am your disciple and a soul surrendered unto me. Please instruct me." So, Arjuna had a material problem, and Krishna, as such a brilliant, best of all spiritual masters, He gave him full spiritual understanding, and then also give very decisive direction as to what to do in this worldly situation. He did both. It was a very difficult situation in terms of religion to make. In the purport to this verse, Prabhupada talks about material perplexities, but in a very basic way, in a universal way, that the same perplexities that everyone has. And if we take a spiritual master, Prabhupada doesn't emphasize that he's going to solve the material problems one by one, like a lawyer, or like a businessman, like a husband, or a general troubleshooter, but that he'll go to the root of them. And thus he says that one who has a spiritual master is supposed to know everything. I mentioned that the other night in the class we had at the temple. Prabhupada explained what that means, that you should know everything the spiritual master knows, but not everything that God knows. And what is that everything that the spiritual master knows? Krishna. He should impart knowledge of Krishna to you. So, in a sense, I'm trying to make a point that the spiritual master is required to give spiritual instructions, not material. But as we go through the scriptures, we also find that the spiritual master is supposed to be able to solve problems. Let us try to consider how we can follow Krishna and Arjuna. We're getting everything from Srila Prabhupada. So, the way he teaches, he also teaches jnana and vijnana. the theoretical answer to problems and an applied solution. And to say it in a very general way, the applied solution is some kind of engagement in devotional service. That's the remedy for the different things that are plaguing us. Then the individually, how one does that and what service he does, that's also to be discussed in a personal relationship. But the vijnana, fortunately we have, to just serve a bhakti principle in this movement, and that should solve our material perplexities. And we certainly have the analysis of jnana. Now, I'll turn to a few sections. Srimad Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita. One is where a Devahuti is approaching her husband, but Prabhupada draws analogies from this for the spiritual master-disciple relationship and his purports. Devahuti was feeling that she didn't take advantage of her relationship with her husband. He was very advanced yogi, and although she was attached to him, she didn't draw the best from him, and so wasted her time. But Prabhupada says, in connection with that, the spiritual master cannot accept service from a disciple without awarding him spiritual instruction. That is a reciprocation of love and duty. So here the burden is on the spiritual master. In faith, disciples come and they render all kinds of services, make sacrifices. So he cannot just accept these things without reciprocating. Prabhupada talks, though, about how sometimes a materialistic disciple wants a certain kind of reciprocation, like a rich person will want to give money to the guru and expect that the guru will flatter him, be more or less like a pet, and not make him stop his sinful activities even, and thus they'll have both a cheating relationship. Or the guru becomes obliged in some other way and commits the ninth offense to chanting, gives confidential instructions or initiation to persons not qualified. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't have a serious obligation. So, but the obligation, Prabhupada says in this sentence, I'll read it again, the spiritual master cannot accept service from a disciple without awarding him spiritual instruction. So that's his duty. Then at the end of the chapter, Devahuti is feeling sorry. She says, I have been solidly cheated by the insurmountable illusory energy, because in spite of having obtained your association, which gives liberation, I did not seek such liberation. And again, Prabhupada, he talks about the guru and the disciple. He says it's a great fortune to take a human form of birth and to meet the spiritual master in the cyclic succession. But people misuse that. Just like the demigod worshippers who want this and want that and want this and want that material thing in their relationship. But we should ask for service. There are two relationships of Lord Chaitanya and his devotees that I'd like to mention here. The first is with Krishna Das, the servant that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took on his southern tour. You know, when they got far to the south, Lord Chaitanya was traveling with this servant, and the servant was lured by some gypsies, Bhattataris. So they send a woman to seduce him, and then he joins their camp and make him a member. So Krishna Das was actually living in their camp. He had gone, he was living in their camp. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went and got him. Later there's a verse praising Lord Chaitanya for going and getting the disciple by the hair. Does anyone know that verse in English?
Glorious is the master.
There's both two parts of it. You just know one. They're both praised, a certain kind of disciple and a certain kind of spiritual master. You know? Begavati. So, even if he does go astray, according to that statement, the spiritual master is expected to go, take the trouble to take him out of the material situation again, bring him back by the hair. However, as we read the actual story, although Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did that, he was displeased. And when he got back to Jagannath Puri, if you want to follow that example that he had him by the hair, he saved him, he let it go. He said, I don't want this servant anymore. You're free of your connection with me. You can do whatever you like. Of course, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's intimate devotees, they took pity on this poor Krishna Das who was crying and very bereft, and they gave him some indirect service so that they could stay connected with Lord Chaitanya. Some very wonderful service. And the other example is one of the sons of Bhavananda Rai, whose sons included Ramananda Rai. So this son is called Gopinath Patnayaka. And he's the one who had a government position collecting taxes, and he was cheating. He was a real he spent his money wildly, and so he got into debt. And then one prince and he had a disagreement, and so in a huff the arrogant prince was going to kill this Gopinath, and he was already up on the platform to be thrown into upraised spears. And then the person started coming to Lord Chaitanya saying, please save him, please save him. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was displeased by these pleas. He said, what do you want me to do? You want me to go to the king and beg? If he's done something wrong, then why should I help him out in his wrongdoing? And this is all materialistic problems. Of course, by Lord Chaitanya's will, he was saved when Lord Chaitanya asked him to pray to Lord Jagannath. But Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu continued to express his displeasure with the whole incident. I cannot stay here any longer, the Lord said. I shall go to Alanath. There are too many disturbances here. As a beggar sannyasi, a mendicant, I wish to live alone, but these people come to tell me about their unhappiness and disturb me. If we hear about the activities of materialistic persons, our minds become agitated. There is no need for me to stay here and be disturbed in that way. He said this to Kashi Mishra after the event, so Kashi Mishra was very frightened. And he agreed with Lord Chaitanya's mood. He said, "Why should you be agitated by these affairs? You are a renounced sannyasi. What connections do you have? One who worships you for some material purpose is blind to all knowledge." If one engages in devotional service, of course he's speaking to him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead also. If one engages in devotional service for your satisfaction, this will result in his increasingly awakening his dormant love for you. But if one engages in your devotional service for material purposes, he should be considered a number one fool. Kindly stay here in Jagannath Puri. Why should you go to Alanath? Henceforward, no one will approach you about material affairs. And of course he explains that this Gopinath, actually, he was not the one who was asking you to save him. He was chanting Hare Krishna, but his relatives were asking on his behalf. So I was making a point that it'll be hard for us to be free of material problems. And we expect so much out of the relationship with the spiritual master, so we go to him with our material dilemmas. How can we just talk about spiritual life or inquire in a pure way if our minds are filled with so many problems? And especially, as it happens from time to time when they get acute, we may be in some acute distress of physical disease or legal implication or problems with other persons and so on, which are material, but that's the nature of this world. So I think there's a way that in times like that we can know that our relationship with our spiritual master is certainly relevant, but what we want from him is spiritual strength. So we can ask him, or we can tell him, I'm having this material problem, so how can I think of Krishna, or how can I turn to Krishna? And although the problem theoretically is one that we might know the answer to, but we're overwhelmed by the material energy. So if we can hear words of instruction that we can follow, it will be very important to us. Words of hope or correction, and they should be spiritual, from the spiritual master. And then, although he's not going to solve that material dilemma, that will be solved by fate or by Krishna's intervention. That's the way things happen in this world. It's not necessarily for our good or for our bad, but these things happen, the threefold miseries, even to a devotee. But how we pass the test, how we remain Krishna conscious during these things is the important thing for devotees. And it's for that we should approach the spiritual master. So he could tell us, for example, how to continue chanting at that time when our chanting seems very difficult to do. Or how to continue, sometimes our troubles are so difficult that we lose faith in Krishna. How to see things in the right way, to understand that Krishna is always our well-wisher. How to be tolerant of the problem. And how to do the right thing. So we've seen Srila Prabhupada deal in this way, and you've read it in his letters. You can read the letters and put together what the person might have been inquiring, that he didn't get into so many material situations. But, for example, when he was first approached by a couple who were breaking up and wanted a divorce and wanted his involvement in one way or another, it was a surprise to him because he had married them, and he became so disgusted that he spoke spontaneously to his servants that I'm going to go back to Vrindavan. I didn't come to preach for this. Why should I have to hear this? But then he tolerated that situation. However, he didn't take one side against another side or something like that in the marriage dispute, but gave spiritual advice. So unless we do this, we'll be disappointed. We'll either not continue to have a strong relationship with the spiritual master, sometimes we even think, well, I have a real materialistic problem, my spiritual master doesn't want to hear this, so I won't communicate with him at all. And when this materialistic problem passes, then I'll communicate. And then it doesn't pass, and there's no communication. But he can be with you at least, and remind you of the priorities of life, and how these material problems are what they are. And that's the most valuable thing that he can give. But if you don't respond to such spiritual instructions, then why is that? Do we lack the faith? Why in our spiritual master? Why don't we feel such inspiration and potency? Why don't we learn how to exchange in the right way? Therefore, we have to help each other. As we read, the spiritual master is accepting service. So he has to clear that burden of accepting service by giving spiritual instruction. But you have to allow him to do that. And the disciple has a burden also of actually surrendering to the guru, in that way approaching Krishna. So they have work to do together. And that has to be done not by resentment on the part of each other or lack of communication and so on, lack of understanding the nature of the relationship, or lack of faith. The spiritual master should see the innate good in the soul and always try to fan the fire, whatever tiny spark is there, for spiritual life. And if the disciple has actually accepted the spiritual master, then he or she should be prepared to hear submissively and to act on the order. Tadvidi panipatena vipashane vasevaya. And then we can start to experience some of the nectar, as is expressed in that verse that I've read to you a number of times in the 10th canto, first chapter. Nibhatatara share upagiyamanat pavosha jak choltram and obiramat ka utamashloka gunanavardat pumam virajeta vina pashugna. The spiritual life is carried out in a relationship of the spiritual master and the disciple, and the messages of Krishna are discussed in that way. These messages are so nectarian, they're the medicine for all the diseases of material life. They are specifically the pastimes of Krishna, and everyone will like to hear them except the killer of the soul. And his purport, Prabhupada talks about the relationship of the spiritual master and disciple as being centered just on talking about Krishna, with no need for talking about what's in the newspapers, and that they're satisfied in this relationship. But this is above one just always struggling with problems and asking for the spiritual master to help with one's problems so that you're not able to hear about Krishna. If one is intelligent, then even while handicapped by so many problems, he will learn how to take that medicine or that nectar in relationship with the spiritual master, and even though it doesn't relieve one of the problems of material life in a certain sense, in other words, maybe your children are suffering and you're suffering some material problems and they don't go away, but you get the deep satisfaction of renunciation and attaining Krishna consciousness in your relationship with the spiritual master. Anyone have any questions? Yes? Well, why, explain a little more. Why did Lord Chaitanya reject his servant Krishnadas? Why didn't he keep him with him and help him? One thing is, he didn't reject him because Lord Chaitanya is all-knowing, so he arranged through his followers that Krishnadas be given another service, and he was chosen to go to Bengal to personally see Mother Sachi and Advaitacharya and deliver them the message that Lord Chaitanya has returned from his tour. So he wasn't rejected. But he was rejected as the personal servant. So let's see, Prabhupada says, Prabhupada just says that this is evidence that one can fall down even in the Lord's association by misuse of free will. Lord Chaitanya needed a very pure and simple person to do that. Therefore, later when he left for Vrindavan, he indirectly said, "Don't give me another servant like the Krishnadas." And so they gave him a very pure, simple-minded Brahmin. So it just caused him so much inconvenience in his service. It's a very intimate service, requiring to know the mood of Lord Chaitanya and in so many ways. So he wasn't fit to do it, but he was given another service. Lord Chaitanya was showing that if you can't follow the rules and regulations, you fall down in illicit sex, it's a disqualification. So there has to be some recognition of that. Not that he remains able to do such a sensitive service. Also, it could be said that it would not be a good example for Lord Chaitanya to keep a person of bad character as his servant. But he was merciful. We can't understand or try to understand it in like material personality and say, well, I can't accept that he should have been kinder. I know somebody who would have been kinder. But Vaishnavera kriye mudra vigena bujaya. Sometimes the spiritual master or the Vaishnava acts like a rose and sometimes like a thunderbolt, but it's always, he knows his business. But even if you consider him hard, in this case, then his devotees were not hard. Prabhupada says, the Lord's devotees are more merciful than he himself. Thus Krishna Das received the mercy of the four devotees mentioned above, Nityananda Prabhu, Jagannanda, Mukunda, and Damodar. But certainly, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he knew what they were doing. There are different ways to be kind at different times. Sometimes you're kind by bringing somebody close. Sometimes you have to be kind by withholding something, like with a child. Kindness isn't always to give the child whatever they want, no matter how naughty they get, as a sign that you love them. But to love them, sometimes you say, this child is going to be spoiled with so much permissiveness. But they should learn something. They're not the center of the universe. In the case of Junior Haridas, Lord Chaitanya seemed particularly hard with him and said that the whole community of Lord Chaitanya's followers, like they all woke up to the dangers of lust, and even in their dreams they didn't dream of such things anymore. So he was teaching, making someone an example. And even that has confidential meanings, that he really didn't reject his eternal servant, Junior Haridas. Yes?
In many places in the scriptures it says that the spiritual master becomes satisfied by the submissive inquiries of his disciple. Does that mean that the disciple should be constantly thinking all the time how to inquire from the spiritual master how to advance in spiritual life, and that is like one prerequisite for actually advancing in spiritual life?
It says in the scriptures that one should inquire from the spiritual master. So should one always be thinking of inquiries to make, and is that a way to advance? Yes, it is a way to advance. As in 434 Bhagavad Gita, service and inquiries, that combination. Prabhupada says, absurd inquiries without service is no good, condemned. So The combination is there. So a lot of it takes the form of asking a question. And as long as it's not just manufacturing an intellectual inquiries only in the mind, but if you really think that I have a great opportunity, I have a spiritual master who is in touch with Krishna, and if I can ask the right questions and if I can hear in the right way, I'll become spiritually learned and realized, and I'll be able to help others, and I'll be able to help myself. So I should make good inquiries. So yes, you should think of them, but how to do that? It has to be done deeply. You can think about it. What now? When I have another opportunity to approach my spiritual master, either by writing a letter or by seeing him, what shall I ask? What question do I have? And then you just have to kind of maybe wait for your unconscious or your heart to reveal it. Say, gee, I don't have any questions, but let me. I know I have so many questions, but I can't think of any questions that are really coming from the right place. The question has to be one that is sincere, not asked from some superficial level. So therefore, I would answer your question, yes, we should always be thinking of making inquiries, how to advance, how to engage in service, but be ready to combine it with the service attitude and do our homework, so to speak. That anyway, where are we going to get the questions? We'll get the questions by engaging in spiritual life, and then things come up we don't know the answer to. We'll get the questions by reading in the scriptures. We read the scriptures and something isn't clear. That's a question to ask the spiritual master. But if we don't do such study or don't practice sadhana, then in the front of a spiritual person we won't have any questions. And if we do have questions, then it will enliven the relationship. The spiritual master will be enthusiastic to answer the questions. When Lord Chaitanya met Sanatana Goswami after he escaped from jail, he was so happy to see him, wanted to embrace him. He said, "Now I have a fit disciple to whom I can teach." And he taught him so thoroughly. But with somebody else, he hardly paid them any attention, because he knew, like in one case, he knew somebody was a bit of a Mayavadi, didn't have love of Krishna and other things. We can even ask a question we asked before and heard the answer to. If we're able to ask it with all sincerity and need. And based on actually trying to practice.
About Devahuti, and of course, because of the nature of her relationship with her husband, him being the husband, she actually misused the relationship, and she didn't take advantage of his association. So we may not so grossly misuse the relationship with the spiritual master, but maybe in more subtle ways, we may not be taking full advantage of that relationship, that either either with some neglect, or on the other side that one is approaching too much for material solutions and like that. So how can we become more aware of, you know, what is our actual attitude towards the relationship, and how can we take advantage of it to the fullest extent?
How can we become aware of what our attitude is?
Well, there may be, maybe in subtle ways, we may not be even consciously aware so much. We may think, well, I respect my spiritual master, but perhaps in subtle ways we're not fully taking advantage of that relationship. Mm.
I can think of a couple of answers. One is to be aware of this relationship. You have your own relationship with your guru, and it's so subjective that maybe you can't see it sometimes. But if you can see the operation in the shastras of so many combinations of spiritual masters and how they liberate their disciples from problems, and how the disciples serve their spiritual masters so nicely, and that may help us to see by comparison what is our relationship. It shouldn't be so vastly different from what the scriptures teach. So then why don't we see that way? And then, although you may have a tainted relationship and you don't know what it is, what's wrong, the spiritual master will know what's wrong. Yasya prasadat, bhagavat prasadat. You have to please the spiritual master. So he knows whether he's pleased or not. The spiritual master isn't partial that he likes certain disciples and doesn't like others. It's not that he likes those who distribute a lot of books and doesn't like somebody who doesn't distribute books or something like that. But he may be pleased with the relationship with one disciple and not so pleased with the other. One could even be, in a certain sense, one devotee could be operating better in ISKCON and following the principles and so on better than another devotee, and the spiritual master would have a better relationship with the devotee who's having more trouble. Possible, because he sees this devotee in terms of relationship. The relationship is pure, let's say. There's nothing devious in the relationship. The disciple may have some problems, but he doesn't have a problem so much in being dishonest or unloving and so on. So the spiritual master will try to help that disciple. If he's a genuine disciple, then he'll rise out of those problems. So in finding out what's wrong in the relationship, the spiritual master can be consulted. He may not want to say, but by being very sincere about trying to improve the relationship, then the obstacles will be revealed in that relationship. Example would be the way Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur approached Gaura Kishore Das Babaji. It was some kind of leela, but still we take it in the way that's handed down to us for lessons, that young Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur was somewhat proud, and so there was something wrong in their relationship. He's supposed to be the disciple surrendering to the guru, but the guru saw he's so qualified and he has a high estimation of his qualifications. So he wouldn't accept him. This is one level of how this can be seen as a lesson. And then when he persisted, then it was revealed to him through the guru what was the deficiency in his relationship and the way he was approaching him. So he finally said, "I need you." And it's not that you'll be benefited by having a learned disciple, but I need you, and if you will not accept me, I'll give up my life. So that changed everything. The relationship became so pure. So I was saying that the guru, if the guru is pleased, then the relationship is successful. And so you want to find that out, but he may not tell you, but if you persist, you'll find out what's wrong. Of course, we have the situation in ISKCON where we're learning from so many sides. We're learning from Prabhupada's books. We're learning from Prabhupada's disciples. And so we have to find within that what is so important about our relationship with our spiritual master. Although it is not the only source of our information, there is something special. Special help Krishna is arranging. And everything is individual, each relationship.
Gurmash, in one sense, when anarthas surface and had to be dealt with, it could almost be viewed as a material problem. But yet it seems that, at least for one who's, in the process of becoming free from anarthas, it's a pretty significant thing to deal with in advancing.
We were giving evidence that you shouldn't approach the spiritual master to serve material problems. But he's saying, what about removal of anarthas? One might call it material, but it's necessary for spiritual advancement. Of course, anarthas are analyzed by the acharyas, but we may use that word in a very general or vague way. In fact, we often do. Without revealing it, what it is, a devotee will say, I have anarthas. Unwanted things, bad habits, is what it means. So, they can be all kinds of things. So, in order to qualify as like a spiritual problem, I would say that someone is sincerely trying to practice spiritual life, but is encountering these unwanted habits. So seeing the sincere effort of the devotee, the spiritual master won't consider it bothered, that he's being bothered to solve the material problem. Like with Gopinath Patnayaka, in so many words, he was being asked to become a politician, go to the king, tell him that this debt will be paid, or pay the debt yourself, as somehow get me out of this trouble. So that was definitely not asking for a solution of the anartha, but to get me out of the material jam that I'm in as a result of my nonsense. But to ask how to get rid of this desire, this bad desire I have, which has resulted in this bad practice that I do, which stops my advancement in Krishna consciousness. We may be ashamed, but that we have to reveal that. And the spiritual master is meant to try to give spiritual instructions for that anartha. But not that the anartha is, that we're attached to the anartha, not really trying to do all we can to rectify it. And the more we can remove them, then we can have a better relationship. We have to be honest. For example, one shouldn't get initiated if he's not following the four rules, things like that. Or if one doesn't follow the four rules after initiation, then he shouldn't. Then that should be at least privately revealed, and he shouldn't therefore be a hypocrite and take positions and honors that should be afforded only to one who's following. So there's honesty is involved, and the attempt to remove the anarthas, and the spiritual master certainly will, he should try to help such a sincere disciple, but not decadence in the relationship where it's sort of like it's supposed to be accepted. There's one devotee, he's been writing to me, he's not initiated for some years, and he wants to get initiated, and he very regularly breaks one of the principles, like, and sort of even like saying that, I don't know how you can expect devotees to follow this, it's very difficult. I said, well, that's the way it is, and we do follow them. Then he wrote me, somewhat angry, and said that you should initiate me. At least I'm honest. He said, anyway, I know ISKCON well enough that most of the devotees, they're not following anyway. So my problem is that I was too honest with you in telling you this. Otherwise, he said, anyway, I can get initiated by somebody else, and I'm going to do that. So I wrote back and said, good, get initiated, but I don't agree with, by somebody else, but I don't agree with you that your mistake was you were too honest with me and that now you shouldn't tell the other person where you're at. I said, that'd be very bad if you do that. And I also said, it's not a fact that you say that everybody in ISKCON is breaking the principles, but some tell it and some don't. So that's like a real perverted attitude towards things. If that's what somebody means by I have an anarthas, meaning that I'm not really doing something to get rid of them, and I want to involve the spiritual master in that way, that he also accepts it, then it's very bad. Then, as we say in general terms, in slightly inflamed language, they both go to hell if they are implicated in such a relationship. So it can be known that my Gurudev knows I've got this problem, and still he accepts me, but he definitely doesn't accept that problem, and I'm working on the problem, and so on. That's one thing. But not that everything is all right, but I'm not getting rid of my anarthas. And my Gurudev says, it's all right, as long as you keep doing your service and collecting money and so on. I better get on to this other question. Oh, we have time. The topic is relationship between ISKCON and other institutions, Vaishnava institutions and non-Vaishnava institutions. Someone says, ISKCON devotees are not very respectful toward even senior devotees, or saints, as I call them, or toward the representatives of other religions. This is bad, and ISKCON members should not be so proud of their status of spiritual life, because after all, we're all children in spiritual life. That's one question or statement. So my reply to this is that I agree that it's wrong if ISKCON devotees are not respectful towards people practicing God consciousness as Vaishnavas, certainly, or in any religion. First offense in chanting is to blaspheme the devotees who dedicated their whole life to chanting the holy name. And Prabhupada says they shouldn't be criticized, they should be encouraged for whatever level of God consciousness they have. That's sadhu ninda. Ninda means offense, and we shouldn't be offensive to anyone, not only to sadhus, but to anyone. I think that's It would be hard to argue against that, that we shouldn't be disrespectful. And I would agree that, but that's a different discussion, whether the ISKCON members are arrogant. Sort of like, should they be arrogant or should they be disrespectful? I would say they definitely shouldn't be. Whether they are, then you have to examine them and see how many are arrogant and how many are not. Or you give examples of somebody who was arrogant. But I wouldn't approve of anybody being arrogant, no matter who he was, even if he was a leader in ISKCON. But I would say that the respect that we offer to persons who are not in our sampradaya should be from afar, or from a distant respect. That doesn't imply anything necessarily too sectarian or insincere, but it's still done from afar for various reasons. And by sampradaya, I mean Krishna consciousness movement from Krishna, the Lord Chaitanya, the six Goswamis, Bhakti Sananda Saraswati Thakur, and Srila Prabhupada. This is the spiritual family that we've joined and that we understand we must have some eternal connection with. And so we are so absorbed in receiving the nectar and assimilating the instructions and worshipping the acharyas in this line that it's not just like a policy that we don't get more involved in showing our respect to others, but we are not able to get to divert our attention due to our taste in this way. In other words, I suspect a little. Suspect means a suspicion could be proven wrong, but I sometimes suspect a statement like this as being not only against arrogance, but coming from a mentality which invites that we should be somehow deeply interested in a broader kind of God consciousness than we are when we hear from Rupa Goswami and from Srila Prabhupada, who, while giving respect to God consciousness everywhere, want us to fix our minds just on Krishna. Prabhupada says in Bhagavad Gita, fix the mind not even on the Vishnu forms, but on Krishna, the two-handed form of Krishna. That's why we come to Vrindavan, to get closer to Krishna. So, I sometimes wonder if there's like a hidden agenda in this kind of request that you should be very respectful towards other sampradayas and other saints and so on. That we're supposed to, what are we supposed to do to show that respect? Are we supposed to go hear from the representatives other than the representatives of our sampradaya, attend their services, develop a new kind of theism of interfaith and so on? I think for the most part we have to be satisfied with this respect from afar, unless you have some particular preaching mission on behalf of ISKCON to develop inroads with other saintly persons. But that's my viewpoint on that. We can have actually no bad feeling toward them, and at the same time just be like a bee that's fallen into the honey of the flower of specific Krishna consciousness and just not able to come out and hear from another point of view. Anybody want to say anything about that?
I recently received a letter from a nun who I've corresponded with ever since, on and off, ever since I became a devotee. And I asked her if not eating meat would have made a difference in her spiritual life. I asked her to respond to that. And just then, her sister, who was also a nun and a vegetarian nun, died. And I got, she sent me the notice of this. And she said for 50 years she was in a cloistered nun and they don't eat any meat. So one day in class I told the devotees that, I said, this is a good example of the type of Christian Prabhupada life.
Yeah.
And for 50 years she followed her practice. So, you know, I felt she was worthy of some respect for doing that.
Yeah. That respect can even include a feeling that person is more advanced than me in so many ways, in dedication to God, service to their movement, renunciation, study habits, and so on. Not that we think, well, because I'm in this, because I'm in Lord Chaitanya's movement, I am better than any nun or monk anywhere else. But I am, the more we advance, we think we're not very advanced. But as to where am I going to learn something, I want to hear from the devotees in this line. Why should we not show respect?
Prabhupada would often, in dealing with Christians, pin them down to their following the Ten Commandments, not killing. It almost seems, I run into Christians all the time in book distribution, but it almost seems like it's hard for me, or at least hard for them to perceive that I'm not criticizing them when I bring that point up. It's almost like one of those preaching points that Prabhupada could do.
Yeah.
But maybe the rest of us can, or something.
Or, yeah, to bring up so abruptly and so quickly,
yeah.
and the way Prabhupada would do, like, I want to talk about this and nothing else. You know, I'm not going to let you get off the spot.
Yeah.
So when you're trying at the same time to establish a friendship or to distribute a book, or it will work against that. Yeah, it may seem like we're too much criticizing. And it's very difficult for them, because they've been told this. Ultimately, they're wrong, but just looking at it psychologically or personally, what are they supposed to do? You know, they would have to change on this. They would have to change and convert, or at least in some degree, say, well, maybe you're right. If there's a friendly, thorough exchange, then we definitely will get into that. And if they are really religious, they probably will go in that direction of being softened by our presentation of non-violence. Yes?
That's one example of Prabhupada on the meat-eating issue. There's another example in dealing in a personal way, which is what you're talking about, or in book distribution, one-to-one, here in India, where there was one, it's in Hari Sori's diary, where there was one friend of the movement, that he owned a store, and they were selling meat. As good as eating meat, you're selling meat. In fact, you're selling a lot more meat than one person can consume. And the devotees were asking Prabhupada how to deal with him. And Prabhupada's instruction was not to tell him to stop his business and selling meat, but that as he chanted Hare Krishna, he would become purified and he would realize himself that he shouldn't do that. So that's an example in the personal way of not challenging a person, but encouraging him, cultivating him.
Yeah. Cultivate him, engage him in positive Krishna consciousness.
I was wondering, is Prabhupada is preaching to Christians in that way, was it mainly to the leaders that he would deal on that level with? Maybe
he often met leaders, but...
Yeah.
He definitely saw it as a very serious defect. I wrote two little essays in Prabhupada Meditation, about that, about how people think that Prabhupada doesn't have an ecumenical spirit, because he always was hitting on that point. But I tried to show how he actually was being ecumenical and opening an area that the Christians will have to recognize, and that in the future Prabhupada will be seen as like a pioneer in establishing relations between religions. for showing the way for them to give that up and still be Christians. You're going to be Christians, he's saying, you've got to give this up because your leader says you've gone off from, he was being their guru, like. They didn't see it that way. They said, oh, you're an outsider criticizing our religion, but it was more like their guru was telling them that you're not following Christ. But they wouldn't recognize him. So it may be that Christianity has changed over the centuries, and maybe it's not too far in the future that they're going to become enlightened about that. And when that happens, you have to certainly give Prabhupada credit for always hammering it away in all his encounters with them. There are already some Christians who, having heard from Prabhupada and remaining Christians, are trying to make a campaign with their fellow Christians that we have to give up meat eating, and that we do have references in our scriptures and our saints that we should give it up. And that it just looks terrible in this age of increased compassion towards animals that we're persisting in this. So Prabhupada was, what he was doing we maybe can't imitate or we can't even fully appreciate, but we should never think that he wasn't doing the right thing.
I was just thinking in terms of when you started to first answer the question, the question about dealing with other religions, and then you mentioned how we should be respectful to all the other religions, and then you talked about our sampradaya. Actually, you talked about that on a tape from a villa in Spain, and you were reading from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and that was his precise point, that we should be respectful before other religions. And we can even bow before a different deity and say, how my worshipful Lord has appeared in this particular form for these people. I'm offering my Lord my humble obeisances. But in that same talk, you also talked about loyalty, or being chaste.
Yeah.
So you're repeating back to the Vinod Thakur's instructions.
Yeah.
This may be the last meeting that we have like this here in Vrindavan. Many of you are going, and my plans aren't so clear or specific, but I also may not stay so long. Or may go out from Vrindavan and come back. But I hope the topic today is relevant, that we can improve our relations and keep up our relations. In a sense, accepting each other as we are, and then aspiring to improve. Vrindavan is, when we come to Vrindavan, and maybe some feel that they didn't do as well as they'd like to, or we'll come back again, try next year, or another year when you come. So things get revealed to us, like our anarthas, but also we get a glimpse of how wonderful spiritual life could be. So it's a good place when these things are happening, to consult the spiritual master. Not that you do it all on your own. We're very tiny, and so many things, even the good things can bewilder us that happen here, and the bad things can bewilder us. So it's a good time and place to continue to stay in close exchange with the spiritual master. Any last things?
true that the
residents of Vrindavan don't require spiritual master?
Well, I once questioned Prabhupada about that. I said, I heard that Krishna is their spiritual master. He said, Krishna may be their spiritual master, but if they don't follow the spiritual master, then what benefit is it? So they require a spiritual master. If you want taking it that they don't need a spiritual master but Krishna, then he's their spiritual master and they have to follow him. But if they live in Vrindavan and do nonsense, don't respect Vaishnavas and so on, it's not that they're perfectly situated. Just by living here doesn't mean that you're perfect. We were reading one essay by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur on this in Harmonist magazine. And he says, if somebody thinks by living in the district of Vrindavan or Mathura in the mundane geography of India that he is actually living in Vrindavan, then he is just as bad as the atheist who doesn't believe in God. He puts him in the same category, like complete ignorant fool. It's not that just by living here that you are in Vrindavan and everything is all right, and you just by saying Radhe, Radhe. But you have to see Vrindavan through the eyes of the sadhu, was the point he was making. So there's a great advantage, but you can misuse it. Just like it's a great advantage, so many great advantages, to take human form of life, to be a follower of Prabhupada, but then you have to actually do the right thing, or the good advantage is wasted. But I thought that was a... Prabhupada can give such concise, penetrating answers. It was such a wonderful answer. He didn't... You could argue whether they need a spiritual master or not, but he just accepted it. He said, all right, so Krishna is their spiritual master, but if they don't follow him, then if you actually examine that answer, then it has so many implications. So someone who says glibly that we meet in Vrindavan, oh, you don't have a spiritual master? Oh, Braj is my spiritual master. Oh, Krishna is my spiritual master. Oh, Braj is my spiritual master. As if we're not going to be so naive to think that just by their saying that they've achieved all discipleship. To have discipleship of Braja or Krishna is no small thing. Most persons, except for some very rare person, will need more than that. They'll need a guru in the cyclic succession. We don't hear it. The Goswamis or their followers saying like that. That I don't need a guru, Krishna is my guru, Vrindavan is my guru. But their works are filled with obeisances to Rupa Goswami, Lokanath Goswami, Yadanandacharya. I never heard that. Krishna is my guru, Vrindavan is my guru. I don't have any other guru. That's for some foolish person. But honoring that he's very special for living in Vrindavan, then let him follow his guru. If we follow the two-handed form of Krishna, how's that connected with being Lord Chaitanya's followers? I was reading a little book just the other night by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu Bindu, and he explains in poetic language how he describes as a lake the pastimes of Radha and Krishna and the devotees, the pure devotees who like to swim in that lake. So he says, in order to do this, they go through first approaching into the lake of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his pastimes, and then they'll be able to come up in the lake of Radha Krishna Leela. So it's definitely connected, just as when you, what is Chaitanya Leela when you read it? Lord Chaitanya's teaching about Krishna in Vrindavan as the highest goal, and he's performing Sankirtan as the way to realize it. He's teaching how to serve Krishna. He's teaching Sanatana Goswami, Rupa Goswami. The way Prabhupada explains it, he says, Krishna came and he said in Bhagavad Gita, surrender to me. But people found it difficult to do, to surrender to God. They thought it's too much. He's inaccessible. So then he came in a more accessible form as the pure devotee of Krishna, Lord Chaitanya, by following him and his teachings. It's the same as following Krishna. Prabhupada says that at the beginning of teachings of Lord Chaitanya. The teachings of Lord Chaitanya and the teachings of Krishna are the same. And they ultimately are to worship Radha and Krishna. But we should do it through the ideal preacher and the ideal example of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the Sankirtan movement. It's the goal of Sankirtan. So don't see them as two different things. Navadvipa and Vrindavan are the same. Anyway, that's a big, big topic. All right, it's getting dark. Mosquitoes will be here soon.
They're already here.
They're already here.